Borders open or closed today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Britain's only land border with the European Union separates Ireland from Northern Ireland.
There are no passport controls, there are no barriers, there's no sign that you're arriving in a different nation.
But that could change if Britain exits the EU. Also, should the EU limit the number of incoming migrants the way the US does?
Whatever that number is, it will never be as large as the number of those who want to come, but it's a lot more than zero.
Plus, keeping Puerto Rico's entrepreneurs from leaving.
What we want to do is offer all of those, you know, very good, talented engineers an option to stay in the island and learn what they would learn if they go to the States.
Those stories and more today on The World. Good to have you with us. Tomorrow, as you know, is a big day for Britain. Voters will decide whether or not to leave the European Union. A so-called Brexit would have huge implications, especially when it comes to borders. In a few minutes, we'll zero in on one of those borders, the one between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. But there are some things a Brexit won't change, at least not immediately. The long line of migrants trying to get into Europe. It's a question the whole continent is wrestling with. How many new foreign arrivals is too many? James Traub of Foreign Policy magazine has been wondering if Europe could learn from the United States on this, so we called him up. James, the U.S. may be in the midst of a 40-year low for illegal border crossings, but Washington's also deporting a record number of people, especially women and children asylum seekers from Central America. What can the U.S. show Europe right now?
Well, Marco, you've pointed to exactly the dilemma, which is obviously the Obama administration is on the liberal side of these questions and left to its own devices wouldn't be doing that. It's doing it because it recognizes that public opinion right now is so hostile to the traditional American willingness to take both refugees and migrants that in order to be able to in effect placate people, to create the political space to do the right thing, which means taking Syrian refugees and means taking migrants who strengthen America, the administration needs to show that it gets it about people's fear on issues of border enforcement. So it has tried to forge a deal in which it says, okay, we'll increase border enforcement in order to get public approval to do other things. The kind of unfortunate bottom line of this so far is that it hasn't succeeded. And so in my article, I say Europe needs to make a similar kind of transaction with its own public. So I can't really say, look, in the United States, it's worked.
So the transaction in Europe with Europeans and European governments has to say what? That we are concerned for your security?
Well, so if you look at the deal that the EU struck with Turkey on the refugees, which has been widely denounced by advocacy groups for details I won't go into, but let's say more broadly, because the view is Europe is protecting itself from refugees at the expense of these refugees who won't be able to come into Europe. They'll be stuck in Turkey. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, who really forged this deal, understood that there was a crisis of political leadership going on in Europe. She had very bravely said Germany will take 1 million refugees, which it did. But that caused German publics to react, and maybe just as seriously, it didn't encourage other European leaders who didn't have the courage to maybe defy their own publics.
I mean, one of the things that you see are the big problems in kind of distinguishing between migrants and refugees. Why is that important?
Well, okay, it's terribly important for the following reason. Refugees are people whose status is covered by treaties and international law. They are, if you are deemed a refugee, you have a right under international law to be given asylum. Migrants are people whose states agree to take because they think it's in their own interest. So they're two completely different categories. The problem is that the world doesn't divide into two parts that way. So think about the situation of someone who comes from, let's say, the Congo. Now, that person may not be escaping because of what refugee law calls a well-founded fear of persecution. But he lives in a country that is utterly chaotic and violent. He has no prospects for the future, and so desperately he leaves. Well, what is he? Is he a refugee? Well, probably not. Is he a migrant in the sense of an economic migrant? Well, not exactly that either. I don't think people have categorically faced this problem because if all those people are judged refugees, Well, then doesn't that mean that millions, maybe even tens of millions of people who come from dysfunctional countries in Africa and elsewhere will say, I can leave because Europe and others will have to take me? That's a terrible problem.
Journalist and author James Traub, thank you very much.
Well, Marco, thank you.
So an argument for tough love there when it comes to migrants and refugees. And speaking of tough love, later in the show we'll head to Germany to hear about the charged debate there over deporting migrants. But let's return for a minute to the so-called Brexit. No one really knows what will happen if Britain decides to leave the European Union in tomorrow's vote. But we wanted to find a place where those unanswered questions might come into sharper focus. So let's talk about Ireland. The Emerald Isle is made up of the Irish Republic to the south and Northern Ireland, still part of the UK, to the north. Right now, both are part of the European Union. But if Britain chooses to leave tomorrow, Northern Ireland would also no longer be part of the EU. The Republic of Ireland would, of course, remain in the EU. My colleague Chris Page is a BBC's Ireland correspondent, and I asked him to describe crossing that border today.
You drive across the border these days and you don't really know that you're crossing from one country into another because there are no passport controls, there are no barriers, there's no sign that you're arriving in a different nation, apart from perhaps the road signs. The speed limits in Northern Ireland are in miles per hour and the speed limits in the Republic of Ireland are in kilometres an hour.
Free movement and no border checks, so you're going from Northern Ireland and the UK to the EU. If the UK votes for a Brexit, presumably a new border would appear, the EU on one side, Northern Ireland and the UK on the other.
Well, this has been one of the key aspects of the referendum debate here in Northern Ireland. Those who are arguing for the UK to remain in the European Union will say that the border will have to be hardened up, that you quite simply cannot have one state in the European Union with a different immigration policy to the other state, which is outside the European Union, and for an open border to be kept in place. The Leave side, though, will say no, actually things don't have to change. They will say that a new arrangement could be put in place.
How much of a role has the EU played in shaping the Northern Ireland that we know today?
What I think is indisputable is that the European Union has spent money here in the form of special peace funding. Since the sectarian conflict here ended in the 1990s, the European Union has sent special money here to fund infrastructure projects, to fund projects which brought both sides together, which promoted reconciliation. For example, projects where children from both nationalist and unionist backgrounds can get together and get to know each other, laying the foundations for a more peaceful future. And those funds have amounted to about $1.5 billion over the last 20 years or so. People on the Leave side will say, yes, that money has come about, but actually it's just come out of the money which the UK has been sending to the European Union anyways.
Chris, have you heard of any fears that the possible reappearance of border controls between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland could kind of play into the old narrative of division, could maybe even damage the peace settlement?
You do hear that from some quarters. For example, Richard Haass, the American diplomat who recently chaired a round of peace talks here, he has spoken of his fears that a Brexit could contribute towards more division in this part of the world. Now, there is a school of thought that says that if there's a Brexit and the border becomes a harder, then that might play into the hands of dissident Republicans, people who believe that the old Republican movement, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, shouldn't have given up the fight and should have continued their guerrilla campaign to try to force Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland, that those dissident Republicans would benefit from a hardening of the border in that it would highlight the fact that the island is still divided by a red line on the map. However, unionists in particular would say that any thought that Brexit could be destabilising for Northern Ireland is absolute nonsense, that the peace process is a result of people within Northern Ireland are coming together, a political process within Northern Ireland itself, and that therefore nobody who is concerned about a Brexit endangering the peace should be thinking that way.
My BBC colleague Chris Page, their Ireland correspondent, speaking with me from Belfast. Thank you very much for your time, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
Honduras has one of the highest murder rates in the world, but even a nation accustomed to such violence was shocked a few months ago by the brutal killing of environmental activist Berta Cáceres.
She was, you know, the most well-known people in Honduras. She won the Goldman Prize last year. She had met the Pope. You know, she was internationally known. And she was supposedly under protection from the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights.
That's Nina Lakhani, a reporter for The Guardian. She's been following the story. Lakhani says Cáceres was shot dead in her home after campaigning against a Honduran hydroelectric dam. Now there are new allegations about her murder. Lakhani says a former Honduran soldier, First Sergeant Rodrigo Cruz, has told her that Cáceres had been on a hit list given to a U.S.-trained Honduran military police unit.
What First Sergeant Cruz told me was that when his commander showed them this list, he told them that the order had come from the Joint Chief of Staffs. Well, the Joint Chief of Staffs is the highest command of the military who takes orders from the government. I was put in touch with this soldier through a trusted source who had to leave the country in fear of his life after his commander in this military police unit was given a list of community leaders, social activists, a hit list that they were expected to find and kill. And the list included names, pictures, email addresses, phone numbers, other personal details.
The soldier told you he is 100% certain that Berta Cáceres was killed by the army. Are you at all skeptical of his claim?
That's what he believes, because he saw her name on the list and 3 months later she was killed. There was two lists. One was to his unit and one was to another unit in another special task force. Berta's name and a picture was on that second list. But obviously we don't know for sure. Unless there is a thorough independent investigation, we won't know. And today the Ministry of Defense and the Secretary to the Government have come out in Honduras and said that the story is completely inaccurate. It's completely false. They're not saying that they're going to launch an investigation to look into it. They refused to respond to any of my questions. All the allegations were put to them and they didn't respond. And now instantly they can say it's not true.
So 5 men have been arrested in connection with Cáceres' murder. Who are they, and do Hondurans have any faith that their government will find the true killers?
There's one major and who was a trainer for the military police. We think 2 of the others who were arrested were previously employed by the military. You know, I think the Honduran authorities are very keen to say job done. We've got 5 people. They're very keen to tell the world that they found the intellectual and the material authors of Bertha's crime. You know, I think there is general disbelief about that.
A lot of social and economic factors led to the coup in Honduras in 2009. I want to ask you about some things that Berta Cáceres said on a radio program in Argentina in 2014. She suggested that then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton endorsed the 2009 election in Honduras, which was simply a continuation of the junta there, no other candidates allowed to run. And Clinton, in her book Hard Choices, frames that endorsement as evidence of her clear-eyed pragmatism. What is your take on Secretary Clinton's actions during that critical moment for Honduras?
The rest of the world made it very clear that this was an illegal coup, that the democratically elected president had been deposed for political reasons by the military and did not recognize the new government, you know, did not recognize the post-coup government. And yet the US said that it would. Clinton called it pragmatism, but was it done for geopolitical reasons? Was it done to favor big businesses who had mining concessions or land, you know, agriculture or whatever? But the election was not a free and fair election, and the US had an opportunity to politically intervene and be on the side of democracy, and they chose not to do that.
Where is Rodrigo Cruz, the former soldier who made the allegations against the security forces? Where is he today?
I can't tell you that. I'm not going to endanger his life. He is not in Honduras because he's in fear of his life, so I can't reveal where he is.
Nina Lakhani writes about Central America and Mexico for The Guardian newspaper. Thanks very much for your time, Nina.
Okay, thank you.
You're tuned to The World. $70 billion is the amount Puerto Rico currently owes its creditors, and the island simply can't pay it. The U.S. Congress is working on a plan to help Puerto Rico fix its financial mess, but many Puerto Ricans say the congressional plan doesn't attack the root of the problem, the economic slump that is Puerto Ricans leaving the island in droves, looking for work elsewhere. But as The World's Jason Margolis reports from San Juan, a small crop of young entrepreneurs is moving back.
If you follow the news from Puerto Rico, you might think the island is on the verge of collapse. Hospitals aren't being reimbursed, schools are closing, and poverty stands at 45%. Jose Lebron and Sheila Torres, who have been married 10 years, heard the stories too.
When we moved here, that was one of our worries. Are we going to move back here to the island where there's a government crumbling down?
Still, the two engineers left good jobs in the aerospace industry in Connecticut to move to Puerto Rico a year ago. They found that some of the stories are spot on, some not so accurate.
Yeah, the government has a lot of debt, but it's still working. The water is still flowing. The power is still going.
And new businesses are opening up. Lebron and Torres grew up in Puerto Rico, went to college here, then earned PhDs in New York. They've come back home to design lighter, smaller solar water heaters. They named their company Sun Cleantech Lab.
It has lab in the name because it's intended to be a product development company of clean energy technologies. And here in the island, there's not a lot of jobs in terms of product development. And what we want to do is offer all of those, you know, very good, talented engineers an option to stay in the island and learn what they would learn if they go to the States.
Besides feeling like, you know, you're staying here because you're proud of your Puerto Rican and you want to rebuild your home, do you feel any responsibility as highly educated young Puerto Ricans?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely every day in my mind. And I think about it all the time. And I think it's a responsibility for me to give back.
They add that the island also offers a small, contained market to test their product. It's easier for them to work here. Vivian Vargas founded the company Berea, an app that rewards customers for uploading shopping receipts, basically couponing through your phone. She says she'd rather be in San Juan than San Jose, California.
We see that in Latin America, there's no one doing something like this, so it was a no-brainer for us, you know, not to compete with the U.S. companies that are doing this.
Vargas is launching her company from within a brand new shared workspace in San Juan, a business accelerator called Parallel 18. 36 companies moved in here in April. The startups get free workspace and $40,000 in seed money from the Puerto Rican government and a local NGO. They also get free advice, says Parallel 18's executive director, Sebastian Vidal.
So we invite mentors every single week so they can teach to the entrepreneurs.
Many of these mentors are also potential investors. It's a big opportunity for a young company to raise cash, although it would be much easier for, say, a video game company to network in tech hubs like Austin, Boston, or the Silicon Valley.
Out there, beyond our cities, stands a wall.
That's a trailer for a multi-platform video game from a new Puerto Rican company called Space Rhino Games.
A light. In the eternal dark.
28-year-old Michael Hoyos founded the company. He had a choice, set up in Puerto Rico or New York. He grew up here, but went to college in the States and bounces back and forth professionally. He says he's very patriotic about his island, and he's got big ambitions to help turn Puerto Rico into a hub for video game makers.
There haven't been any new industries, any new job creation for a very, very long time. Like, the last job creation boom we had was in the industrial era, you know? That was over 50, 60 years ago. We need to start training for future jobs.
But he concedes he's taking the harder path, setting up in San Juan.
Yeah, it would be much easier to do in Silicon Valley.
Hoyos said Puerto Rico develops a lot of talented engineers, but it's tough to keep them here.
Specifically now, because software engineers get paid so much in the mainland, and they're in such high demand, like getting one of these guys to actually stay here, and basically a huge pay cut, it's tough.
His sales pitch? Be part of the generation that rebuilds Puerto Rico. It's persuasive. Most young Puerto Ricans I met say they want to stay here. After all, it's home. They just need a reason, a job, to keep them from leaving. For The World, Jason Margolis, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Now we turn to another place dealing with a down economy, Cleveland. But at least the city's got a number one pro sports team. The Cleveland Cavaliers won their first NBA championship in franchise history, and today, the victory parade.
Già tantissima gente, questo è l'esterno della Quicken-Loans Arena, una delle entrate principali.
That sports reporter Davide Chinilato filing for his newspaper La Gazzetta dello Sport back home in Italy. Yeah, this is not just big news in Cleveland. We called Chinilato up earlier and asked him to describe the scene along the parade route.
The city's going nuts. There's like 1 million people on the streets. You know, everyone is rooting for the Cavs. So happy, so excited about this parade and this team winning the title.
The Cavaliers clinched a 7-game contest on Sunday night after trailing the Golden State Warriors in the series. Finals MVP and hometown favorite LeBron James led the comeback. But Kinalato says Cleveland fans aren't only heaping praise on number 23.
I've been speaking with fans along the parade, and what I heard is that each and every one of them prove a sense of pride. Of pride to be a Clevelander, of pride to be rooting for a championship team. The curse is over, it's what they're telling me. They've been waiting for celebrating a title for 52 years. Everyone has a story to tell about. We were sad. We were always getting there, almost getting there, but never celebrating. And now we could celebrate.
Maybe it's because the Cavaliers have never won a championship, but Kinalato says the party in Cleveland's unlike anything he's ever seen in Italy.
I once covered AC Milan's celebration for the Serie A title, and what I'm seeing now is not comparable. And you can see everyone in the city, everyone here, everyone, really, every single people in Cleveland is celebrating, wearing a Cavalier t-shirt or something like that. The adrenaline is already high, and maybe I can compare this to when Italy won the Soccer World Cup in 2006.
Davide Kinalato there in Cleveland, covering the celebrations of the Cavaliers' NBA victory for his newspaper, Italy's La Gazzetta dello Sport. Later here on The World, we'll tell you about a new version of Mein Kampf that's stirring controversy in Germany, and we've got the story of a dramatic rescue at the South Pole here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the Netherlands, living with rising sea levels sometimes means dealing with more water and fewer people.
When I go with my boat, one moment it's amazing. But sometimes, you know, I have also some tears because I miss my neighbors.
That story's coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier on the show today, we were dealing with the question, how many new refugees and migrants counts as overwhelming for a country? For Europe, they haven't seen this many people on the move since World War II. Back then, it was a war Germany started that caused a lot of that displacement. But now, in the midst of the current migrant crisis, it's Germany that's been most welcoming. They've taken in more than 1 million migrants and refugees last year. But just because those people got there doesn't mean they have the right to stay. And that means deportation, which is a touchy subject in Germany. From Berlin, Daniel Estrin has our story.
One rainy day last week, I met an off-duty German police officer. He said his name was Michael, but that wasn't his real name. He's not permitted to speak to the press about his job. Deporting illegal migrants.
Waren eine Vietnamesin, also so viel kann ich sagen. Da ging es um eine vietnamesische Person, eine vietnamesische Frau.
We were standing in front of the apartment building he visited 2 weeks ago to deport a woman from Vietnam. Germany had rejected her request for asylum.
2 weeks ago you were here. What time at night was it?
Weil Vietnamesen sind entweder ganz früh erreichbar oder ganz spät abends.
Michael laughed. They didn't show up in the middle of the night to catch her by surprise. They came for her at 12 noon, when most people aren't home. You might be able to guess how this ends. Michael and his police team went inside and up the elevator to the woman's floor. They knocked on a neighbor's door, asked where the Vietnamese woman lived. The neighbor pointed to her door.
Which door was it?
Also, es wäre allerdings nicht in der Etage die gewesen.
It would have been this door.
The police knocked. No answer. An officer thought he heard some rustling, so they rammed down the door. And no one was there. So the police called workmen to fix the door, filled out paperwork, and left. Mission failure. This happens a lot. A senior police official told me police only manage to round up 50% of the people they're sent to round up. They'll try to come back for the woman in about 2 weeks' time. But they may not find her then either. Most deportation attempts happen in the middle of the day. It's not the kind of tough treatment you'd expect from police sent to deport an illegal migrant. Some say we're too nice, Michael says. Up until a few months ago, deportation police were not allowed to break down doors to round up migrants without a special court order. They're allowed to now, but he says they rarely do. And when they do round people up, he says, they'll do them favors. Like they'll take them to a cash machine to withdraw money from their German bank account before putting them onto an airplane.
Hab jetzt nicht so das Problem damit, was nicht heißt, dass man da nicht irgendwie menschlich reagiert. Also man hat schon.
We bring a certain amount of empathy to the situation without too much aggression, Michael says. Getting rid of illegal migrants puts Germans in a painful position. The last time Germany rounded up masses of people was the Holocaust. Engelhard Mazanka, the head of immigration affairs for Berlin, says German officials use all kinds of synonyms to describe the current deportations, just not the German word Deportation.
Auf Englisch Deportation, was wir auf Deutsch nicht so gerne hören, weil es Nazi-Vergangenheit ist, Deportation.
He says it sounds too much like the Nazi deportations of Jews. Plus, deportations are used as a last resort here. German authorities bend over backwards to encourage people to leave on their own. They give them free plane tickets, even thousands of euros to invest in their new lives back home. Many migrants have accepted these offers and left, including some Iraqis. But some are not hurrying to leave. And you can understand why. Germany continues giving all migrants free rent and social benefits, even after their application for asylum has been rejected. Meantime, the migrants are changing the face of the country, and public support for the far-right, anti-immigration political party Alternative for Deutschland has shot up. But immigration officials like Mazanka say the migrants have been a good thing for Germany. When he talks about it, his eyes well up with tears and his voice breaks.
Mut, Stolz. Und Ehrlichkeit.
Germans need courage, honesty, and pride, he says. Courage and honesty to admit that Germany still has not perfected the integration of more than 1.5 million people from different cultures. But pride that Germany, despite its dark history, is now a place people from around the world want to live, to feel secure. For the World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
There are other examples of Germany's dark history reverberating today. Take the case of German authorities considering legal action against a publisher there that wants to sell Adolf Hitler's book, Mein Kampf. It was first published in 1925, and it contains Hitler's blueprint for German domination of Europe. It's also violently anti-Semitic.
Mein Kampf was taken off the market right after World War II.
Reporter Daniel Gross has been following the story.
The main anxiety was just, what if this kind of regime could come back? And this was actually done partly with American influence. Americans wanted to take all the Nazi symbols out of Germany and make Germans feel that they were responsible for the acts that had happened there in Germany. And so they took the copyright, which belonged to Hitler and then reverted to Germany when he died. And they just said, you know, we're the only ones who can publish anything and we're not going to, so nobody will get a copy.
So the copyright on Mein Kampf ran out last year and a new version has been republished. What's going on with this version?
So the first version that came out was scholarly. It was 12 pounds, and it had 3,700 footnotes in it. So this is something that only a very dedicated scholar would be interested in. But the cause for concern is a right-wing publisher called Der Schelm has released an edition that has no scholarly commentary.
Tell us more about this company, Der Schelm. What are they trying to do with this?
Yeah, I mean, Der Schelm is pretty blatantly right-wing. You could probably say that this is a neo-Nazi press. Der Schelm means prankster, by the way, in German. So it's sort of a provocative organization. And their edition is really supposed to be supportive of Hitler. I think it's masquerading as a historical text, but I don't think that fools anybody.
So how do they get around the anti-Nazi propaganda laws?
They haven't yet. That's sort of yet to be seen. There are lawyers who are considering suing the company, and their argument will probably be that this is either incitement or this is Nazi propaganda.
So 70 years after World War II, I mean, is anybody in Germany saying now it's kind of paternalistic for authorities to try and control ideas? I mean, it's like they can't trust their own people.
It is. It's a fairly German attitude to feel that anxiety with that intense memory of World War II. But I did speak to, for example, a friend of mine who goes to anti-fascist rallies in Berlin quite a lot. He didn't have any concern about this original edition. And I don't think the anxiety is there for historians. I mean, historians are saying we need these texts to understand what happened in the 20th century. But a lot of the reporting around this has been kind of scaremongering. I think that journalists have reported on this as if the very publication of Mein Kampf or the interest in Mein Kampf is a sign that we're lurching to the right in Europe. And I don't really think that's the case. I think it's not so much about whether the book is being read, but how the book is being read. Is it being read with a critical eye that empowers people to maybe resist ideas like this in the future?
I mean, interestingly, in other parts of the world, like Britain and here in the United States, you can buy Mein Kampf, and it is read, and it is studied. Annotations are not.
Yeah, and it's in the public library in many places in the United States. And I think we know from the American experience that banning a book often creates an obsessive interest in it. And I think that, you know, some historians have argued that's what happened in Germany, that 70 years of not being able to get this book, unless you maybe browsed online where you can get it, generated this interest in it that pushed it to the top of the bestseller list when it did come out.
It really feels like Germany is still wrestling with the whole idea of Nazi propaganda, Nazi thought. Is that coming to a rest, you think, with this expiration of this copyright?
It's hard to say if that attitude will go away. I mean, Germany is absolutely still wrestling with World War II. And it's an interesting moment because, you know, the generation that would have seen Hitler speak and remembers this is dying off. And we're really at the end of that moment when it's a personal story. And now Germans have to decide what part of the history they want to inherit.
Journalist Daniel Gross, thank you very much.
Thank you.
During World War II, the Dutch had to contend with the Nazis. The Dutch also had their eternal struggle with the North Sea, and they still do. Much of the Netherlands is at or below sea level. That means the Dutch have centuries of experience using dikes to keep their low-lying country dry. But the threat of rising sea levels, driven by climate change, is challenging that approach. So instead of trying to hold the water back, the Dutch are now allowing some parts of the country to flood in order to keep other parts dry. Chris Bentley with our partners at the Ground Truth Project has the latest installment in our series on rising seas.
Matthew Schouten is a landscape architect, and like most Dutch, he gets around a lot by bike. Today, he's riding along the top of a dike in Nijmegen, an old Dutch city near the German border. Nijmegen sits at a bottleneck on a branch of the Rhine River. Flooding's been a big risk here pretty much forever, so the Dutch have built and reinforced dikes here pretty much forever to protect the city. But about 20 years ago, their defenses started to crack.
In 1993 and 1995, the dike almost failed, and 200,000 people are evacuated, and that was really a wake-up call.
Schouten says another wake-up call came in 2000. When new climate change projections showed likely flooding and sea level rise overwhelming many of the country's dikes. So the Dutch made a big change. Instead of more and higher dikes to defend against water, they came up with a new approach called Room for the River.
Yeah, Room for the River, exactly.
Basically, the government conceded that it can't avoid flooding entirely. Better instead to try to manage floods by clearing out space for high water. Here in Nijmegen, that meant moving the dikes back and recreating some of the river's original floodplain. But dozens of families were living in that floodplain.
Of course, in the beginning, they were against this whole measure.
Schouten says the families behind the dikes dug in their heels and that it took years of negotiations to work out an acceptable plan.
But in the end, they are the best ambassadors for us yet.
Ambassadors like Frank and Monique Pleim. They had a house and an auto body shop in the proposed new floodplain.
First of all, no, we don't want it.
No, it was a long time for not knowing where we can live, where we can go further our work.
But after 11 years haggling with the Dutch government, the Pleims took a buyout and moved across the river. They remembered the floods of the 90s, and ultimately, they say they got a fair deal for their land.
All the people here have money from the government, and all the people have built a new house.
It was a difficult period, but I think the most of the people did it. They are satisfied.
The Pleims' new house is bigger and taller. Since it's close to the river, it sits on stilts. They say they love their new view of the water and the sky, and it's just up the road from their old place. Not everyone stayed so close. One family took their buyout money and moved to Italy. The Pleims adopted their cat. Nijmegen isn't the only Room for the River project uprooting neighborhoods. Sail down the Rhine about 50 miles and you come to the Biesbosch, just east of Rotterdam.
The Biesbosch is a
big nature area, but people live here too.
That's Robert de Koning, another landscape architect who's worked on what's known as the Noordwaard depoldering. A polder is a low-lying area protected from flooding by dikes and water pumps. And Noordwaard is a big one.
It's an area where the two big rivers come together.
Like in Nijmegen, the Dutch government decided to essentially abandon the flood protections at Noordwaard. They'd let the water spread out here to prevent catastrophic floods elsewhere.
It's not preventing floods, but it's preventing a dike breach.
There's an added benefit, too. The project restored 25 miles of creeks, creating a wetland that's already popular with birders and bikers from all over the country. But before it was a flood control project, the Noordwaard was a village, and people still live there. People like Annika van Lelyveld.
Okay.
Her family has lived in the area for generations. So 20 years ago, when the government first started talking about depoldering the Noordwaard, van Lelyveld got involved.
It was a long time. It was a hard time. It was a learning process for everyone, for us, but also for the government.
Ultimately, the government gave people a choice. If your house was at least a meter above the new high water level, you could stay. If not, they'd buy it, raise the land on your property, and then let you rebuild. Van Lelyveld's house is on a levee, already high up, so she didn't have to move. But her garden became a construction zone, and a lot of her neighbors are gone.
Everything was out. Every tree, every building, everything. And they said to us, it's going to be for 6 months, but it was 4 years.
She's happy to have her garden back, and some small compensation from the government. The new wetlands are also nice, she says.
But sometimes it's hard for me. When I go with my boat, one moment it's amazing. But sometimes, you know, I have also some tears because I miss my neighbors. Yeah, that's a mixed up emotion.
It's complicated for people like van Lelyveld. She's sad about what's being lost. But she's proud that people are visiting from all over the world to see what the Dutch are doing to prepare for a new future.
Because the Dutch people always been building dikes, dikes, dikes. And now they are crazy. They're giving land back to the river. Mm. But there's something changing. The climate is changing. There are troubles. And, well, there must something happen.
What's happening here is painful. But the Dutch believe the alternative is far worse. And that may make the Netherlands an example for other low-lying regions facing the same trade-off. Sacrifice today or risk even more tomorrow. For the world, Chris Bentley, outside Rotterdam, the Netherlands.
Tomorrow on the show, how Dutch know-how may help protect the world's largest naval base. Our series on rising seas continues in Norfolk, Virginia. Be sure to join us. I'm Marco Werman with The World. The scene in Houston last night was grim. The U.S. soccer team got trounced by Argentina 4-0. Now, if you're a hater, you say it's time to get rid of Jurgen Klinsmann, the German coach of the U.S. team. But hang on. This was the semifinals of the Copa America, the top competition for this hemisphere, against Argentina, one of the best teams in the world. Stephen Goff's been covering the tournament for The Washington Post. He says, don't put on that fire Klinsmann t-shirt just yet.
I don't really blame him as fully as some fans do. I mean, I'm sure that's frustration, but the fact of the matter is it wouldn't have mattered that much who was on the field. I mean, the U.S., they had three starters who were suspended, so they were already in a deep hole. And, you know, it's another class of soccer, Argentina and the U.S., in a competitive match. In a friendly where the intensity's lower and you see a variety of different players and a lot of substitutions, yeah, you know, maybe it's a little more competitive. But when there's something at stake and Lionel Messi's in top form, you know, I don't think it really matters who's on the field for the United States.
It does make me wonder, actually, what American soccer style is. I mean, the Germans are technicians. Brazilians have the beautiful game. Premier League is very much a beautifully controlled ground game. Do we Americans have a style?
No, I mean, a lot of those styles are kind of generalizations now. I mean, the Germans, yeah, they've always been known for their efficiency and everything, but if you watch them at the last World Cup, they played great soccer. I mean, it was fantastic. Brazil, known for the beautiful game, they don't play beautiful soccer anymore. I mean, it's been years since we've seen Brazil play beautiful soccer. So, you know, these things are kind of myths. In terms of the U.S., when they are successful, it's when they compensate for lack of high-level technical skills with grit, perseverance, team effort, you know, all the intangibles that are needed in a game. So style-wise, I mean, you need the players to play a certain style. And, you know, the fact of the matter is the U.S. does not have many world-class players. So, they try to compensate in other ways.
Is compensation a style, though?
What can you do? What options do you have? I mean, there are no Americans playing in La Liga. There are no Americans attackers playing at the high levels of England. So, you know, you have limitations and, you have to try other things. Overall, this was a successful tournament for the U.S. They were the only CONCACAF team to get to the semifinals. They beat a very good Ecuador team in the quarterfinals. You know, losing 4-0 is not the way you want to go out. They still have a third place game. But overall, the best people realistically hoped for was the quarterfinal. So to get the semis, they'll consider this a success.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. So one final question about Jurgen Klinsmann. I mean, people look at the defeat against Argentina 4-0 and say, Jurgen Klinsmann should go. You seem to be saying this semifinal match is why he should stay. What do you think? I mean, why is he still there?
Nah, I mean, look, his job is not in the slightest bit of danger. I mean, this is a long-term plan for the U.S. Soccer Federation. They signed him to a long-term contract before even the last World Cup. They see him molding not just the national team, but player development and the vertical integration of players. So, you know, this isn't about single results. It's not about single tournaments. And, you know, barring some cataclysmic event in World Cup qualifying, which is unlikely because it's a lower standard of play in CONCACAF, you know, he's going to be the coach, you know, for better or worse, in the next World Cup.
Stephen Goff covers soccer for The Washington Post. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Finally today, a dramatic rescue mission. Early this morning, in the icy cold and pitch black of the Antarctic winter, a small plane touched down near the South Pole. It picked up two workers at the U.S. science base there as part of a historic medical evacuation. The rescue is only the third ever staged at the South Pole during the Southern Hemisphere's winter. Our reporter Carolyn Beeler has been following the story today and joins us now in the studio for an update. Why is this kind of rescue so rare, Carolyn?
Marco, basically because it's extremely dangerous. And it's so dangerous for two reasons. It's really cold right now in Antarctica, and it's really dark. The temperature this morning at the South Pole was about negative 76 degrees Fahrenheit, and most planes just can't operate at those low temperatures. Their mechanical parts freeze up, and they just won't work. And the second reason, like I said, is darkness. It's dark for months at a time this time of year at the South Pole. And I talked to the National Science Foundation spokesman, Peter West, about this, and he said that even with the sophisticated navigational tools that pilots have these days, that much darkness still poses a real challenge.
There are lights at the station, and they did light the runway, but nonetheless, over the continent, which is the size of the U.S. and Mexico combined, there are very few navigational aids.
So it's easy to get lost on this long journey. West also mentioned the weather, which aside from the cold can get blustery and snowy and icy, and that really also is hard to fly in.
So apparently this rescue operation started last week in Calgary in Alberta in Canada, and the plane touched down just at the South Pole this morning, East Coast time. Why this long lead up?
So like I said, Marco, there are very few planes that can do this type of flight. So the ones that the NSF works with are actually flying missions in the Arctic right now. So when they had to be called down to the Antarctic, it's a very long flight. Peter West, who we heard from earlier, says they had to fly up from Calgary, where they're based, to do this very sort of roundabout global tour.
So they had to fly down from Calgary through Colorado, Colorado to Ecuador, Ecuador to Chile, Chile to Rothera, where they prepared for the flight.
Wow, what a trek.
Yes, Rothera is the British Antarctic Science Station about 1,500 miles from the South Pole, and that was used as base of operations for this mission, and the flight just returned there from the South Pole safely, so good news for the NSF.
Right, and good news for these two patients who were evacuated. What were they doing exactly down at the South Pole, and where were they being taken to be treated? Do you also know what's wrong with them?
We don't. The NSF, who I should mention, manages the science that the U.S. does down in Antarctica. They're not giving a lot of details to protect the privacy of these patients. It seems that one was in the most dire condition and needed to be evacuated. The other was kind of brought along for the ride.
Right.
Probably wouldn't have been evacuated if this first person didn't need to be. We do know that they worked for or through Lockheed Martin, who does a lot of the staffing down at the base. There are about 40 people who overwinter at the South Pole Station running science experiments for the NSF and doing maintenance work.
I remember back in 1999, there was a doctor at the South Pole who had cancer, breast cancer, and she treated herself, was giving herself biopsies for the winter months. Cancer is really serious. How does the National Science Foundation decide when to evacuate someone and when not to?
Yeah, that was a crazy story. Mm. It basically comes down to risk for the patients who potentially need to be evacuated versus risk for the crews who are going to be running the evacuation. So the NSF consulted with outside medical professionals in this case and decided to go ahead and run the evacuation.
Right, and the risk paid off. They got him out.
Yeah.
Great news. Carolyn Beeler covers science and the environment for us. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Yeah, great news is, what can I say, great. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.